You're listening to The Leonard LoPage Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Every time a communication technology has been invented, the telegraph, telephone, radio, film, TV, the internet, there's a wave of optimism that it will lead to a better society. In his new book, The Master Switch, The Rise and Fall of Information Empires, Columbia Law professor Tim Wu argues that the new technologies eventually betray their commitment to openness and become part of a corporate industrial structure. Mr. Wu is chair of the Free Press Board and a regular contributor to Slate magazine. His book is published by Knopf, and I'm very pleased to welcome him to our show. Hello.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Are you looking to the various technological inventions in the 20th century in order to explain the future of the internet?
It's an effort to understand our times, I suppose. I think we're in a period, and we've been in a period of incredible optimism, a sense that everything is changing and the world will never be the same again. And I wanted to know what happened in the past.
Well, the internet has been seen as an unprecedented medium of openness, immune to the usual corporate pressures. Should we be concerned then?
It is a medium of openness. My book is suggesting it's not unprecedented. That is to say, when radio came along, we also thought that this was an unprecedented medium of openness, and it also gave rise to a boom, as you said earlier, of openness and free speech and tons of diverse stations.
And anybody could have his own station in those days. You could just, if you found your own frequency, you could just broadcast from your house, couldn't you?
Yeah, it was much easier to open a radio station then than now, much easier. And in fact, similar to setting up a website. I won't say it was everyone. It was usually schools or radio clubs or motorcycle clubs that have radio stations in the 20s. But yeah, it was much easier than it is now.
One revolutionary aspect of the internet is that it's an electronic network that's not tied to any one physical infrastructure. Isn't that enough to save it from corporate consolidation?
That's kind of the central question in the book. There were revolutionary ideas at the center of the internet when it was founded in the 60s and 70s. The internet was part of a backlash against centralized control, against all these giant companies and, in fact, federal agencies that were running everything, AT&T, and a giant administration. It was a small is beautiful kind of backlash, and it is designed to resist central control.
Well, we have the FCC to worry about, and if you say certain words, I get into trouble.
Yeah, I'll try to avoid that.
But you understand.
Yes.
There are certain rules here.
Yep.
The internet doesn't have those rules, and as we're seeing recently with this big brouhaha over this pedophile book in Amazon,
right?
People still see this as a matter open to debate.
Right. It doesn't have those rules now, and it was designed to be open, and those are very important features of the network. The question is whether it's subject to the same powers of consolidation and integration that have affected all of its predecessors.
What you call a cycle.
Information
industries go through a cycle, starting out as open sectors of the economy, and then they become controlled by private interests and also by the government.
Right, and by the government. There's signs that some of what has happened to other media may be happening to the internet. And it's you know, I don't know the future, but you look at a company like Apple, very carefully following the playbook of NBC and Hollywood studios in the early 20th century, integrating content, devices, all in a very beautiful, attractive package, but a much more controlled package than the original internet envisioned. We have cable companies like Comcast buying NBC, integrating all of that content together. Some of the signs of closing are back.
And you say AT&T has been the most powerful of all of the gatekeepers of information?
In history, over American history, yes. AT&T had an enormous influence, and much of my book is about the rise and fall of AT&T in the 20th century.
Well, it's having a kind of a rise again, isn't it?
Well, it is. One thing that's interesting is AT&T was a monopoly for 70 years, broke up in 1984, and rather like the Terminator robot. The little pieces found themselves back together by 2006, and not a lot of people noticed that AT&T actually came back. You know, we broke it up, and Ma Bell was no more, and then it slowly came back together. It's two companies now, AT&T and Verizon, but, you know, two sides of the Roman Empire, essentially.
But they are, in theory, in competition, and AT&T now has been helped a lot by its connection to the iPhone, hasn't it?
That's definitely right. They are.
So right, for a moment, anyway, they still have a monopoly on that.
That's correct. They do. And it is, that's right. And it was a surprise, actually, because at that point, when Apple launched the iPhone, it was very close allies with Google. And it surprised them by doing this exclusive deal with AT&T, who is Google's enemy. And so there's a very interesting story of essentially Apple's betrayal of Google that is detailed in the book.
And Verizon is now doing some kind of a deal with Google, the other side of Ma Bell.
A response. And it's a typical it's typical in the history and from studying the history that at a certain stage in the evolution of a medium, you start to have two or three giant coalitions struggling to control it. Right now, the great battle that we see between Apple and Google over mobile is a struggle that has a lot of historically very similar to the battle over Hollywood theaters in the 20s.
But hasn't there been a battle within some of these companies? For example, Apple was created by two Steves who seem to have very different attitudes about openness.
There's been a fascinating struggle for the control of Apple since its inception, because Apple is the company that pioneered open computing at a personal level with the Apple II, 1977. It was the leader, the ideological visionary who created this idea, a reaction against IBM, really, and AT&T, these centralized huge institutions, the mainframe, this device that everyone could have that would sort of free them. Apple is now leading a campaign against the personal computer to replace it with the iPhone and the iPad and iPhone.
Their own, they became successful because of the personal computer.
Right.
And now they're undermining their own success.
Right. There's a certain, well.
They have a different vision.
Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak have always had very different visions, the two founders of Apple. Steve Wozniak has always believed in openness and empowering users. Steve Jobs has always believed in creating the best possible product, and that sometimes means having total control over everything. He's a centralizer in his personality.
Well, why does that then lead to some kind of a corporate takeover? Because they're now relying on the telephone companies to carry the information instead of doing it through the regular internet?
Right. I want to emphasize – I want to emphasize that we're not quite there yet. But the elements are – you know, the internet's been a mass medium for about 15 years, and it typically takes about 25 years. So I would
for the cycle to turn.
So if we're following history, it'll be another 10 years. But the patterns are there, and it begins with a company, as I've said, integrating. So Apple chooses – or selects the content for the users. It delivers it through its sort of protected channels, the iTunes download store, and it essentially hooks you into its devices. Apple's not the only company doing this, but they're using the techniques in the most obvious way. And eventually, you end up in a situation where the firm has more control than we had before over what everyone views.
My guest is Tim Wu, WU. His book, The Master Switch, The Rise and Fall of Information Empires. Okay. Is this cycle inevitable, or does it need the support of something like the FCC or some other government agency?
It's a very good question. I think the cycle is natural. That is to say, I think there is a natural move from open industries to closed, consolidated industries that repeats. That's what the book shows over and over again. But it doesn't. But two things about the role of government. First of all, government can influence the cycle by granting one company a monopoly over an industry. This is what the government did with NBC and CBS.
And it's done with gas and electric, hasn't it?
And
cable, too.
Yeah, that's right. So the government can help out a corporate monopoly by granting a monopoly, protecting its monopoly, and that is very important. It can also destroy monopolies by breaking them up. So it does have an important role. But it can also try to prevent consolidation. So the government is involved at every stage.
Well, some of those monopolies are called natural monopolies, meaning it's just too expensive for a competitor to enter an industry, or too complicated. If we were having four or five different electric companies all competing mm-hmm. to supply us with electricity, the wiring problems would be mm-hmm. outrageous.
You know what's an interesting example of a natural monopoly in our time is Facebook. Facebook is a company that gets more valuable the more people use it. You know, if you have a social networking site with 30 people on it, it's not valuable. So, but one with 500 million, suddenly you have to be on it. And there's a sense that instead of the oil and gas pipelines it's actually the connections of friends that are creating, or the need for a single network that is creating natural monopolies in our time.
Well, who are the superpowers of the internet right now?
Well, you know, it's still slightly divided. You have, I think the main big players are the big carriers, Verizon, AT&T, Comcast, and then Facebook, Google, and Apple. These are the major players, and each of them is in some sense struggling to become the emperor that rules them all.
Is this something that only computer geeks will notice?
I doubt that. I don't know who in the audience, anyone here who doesn't use Google at least once a day, or Facebook, or one of those companies is, I salute you for your independence from technology, but most of us get our information through these channels.
But it is interesting that Google started off as the best place to get information, at least that was its reputation, and it's worked that way for me.
Yeah.
But now Google seems to be doing all sorts of other stuff that has nothing to do with me finding out when a certain politician was born.
It's a classic example of, you know, imperial creep or something. You start with a certain set of priorities and move to others. Google's a company that deeply fascinates me because it is both a monopolist and a powerful monopolist, but also a company that dedicates itself to trying to be good, or at least it says so. And that combination is very fascinating to me. It's the same thing that AT&T promised America in the 1910s. It said, okay, yes, we're going to be a monopolist of the telephone, but we are going to serve the public. And for that reason, we said, okay, be in charge. We like you. And we're kind of doing that with Google now. American public, yeah.
Well, from the user's point of view, there has been this idealism of the internet revolution that we saw especially in the 80s and 90s. Is that being undermined?
Is it being undermined? I think the idealism – the really interesting question is whether – you can trust a company like Google to be the carrier of the idealism that the public has. You know, you have everyone thinks the internet is going to break down the connections between the barriers between humans and create a more unified society. But of course, someone has to do it. And the question is it enough to trust a few companies that seem good to do that for us?
My guest is Tim Wu, who is a professor at Columbia University. In 2006, he was recognized as one of the 50 leaders in science and technology by Scientific American magazine. And then the following year, he was listed as one of Harvard's 100 most influential graduates. He writes for Slate. He's also written for The New Yorker, The New York Times, Time, The Washington Post, Forbes. And he's written a book called The Master Switch, The Rise and Fall of Information Empires. It's published by Knopf. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Tim Wu. His book, The Master Switch, The Rise and Fall of Information Empires, published by Knopf. Every time a new technology comes along, there are predictions that it's going to kill the old one. That worked to some degree with the telegraph when the telephone came along. But radio didn't kill the telegraph or the telephone. TV didn't kill radio.
Right.
And now we're hearing that the internet is going to take over everything.
Yeah, this is a story I talk about a lot in my book. One of the most fascinating things that happens when you see a disruptive new technology is there's usually an effort to kill it, to destroy it in the cradle, or to co-opt it and make it safe for the existing dominant industry. No sooner was the telephone launched than the telegraph company, then monopoly, Western Union, moved in to destroy it, almost did. Telephone barely survived and then went on eventually to extinguish the telegraph. In the 30s, there was a different story. There was a TV industry, new TV industry, that the radio industry managed to control and delay for about 15 years and launched its own image. And a final example, many people don't know this, but FM radio, what we're listening to now, was suppressed for about 40 years by the AM industry, which didn't want a whole bunch of radio stations because then people might not listen to their
radio
stations.
Right, it would dilute the listenership. And that's what's happened with cable, hasn't it?
Oh, cable was suppressed for about 20 years by broadcasting interests and the federal government, frankly, who just thought it was confusing and bad. And the internet itself, the technologies were kept. The federal government luckily was funding the internet, but AT&T was strongly opposed to the establishment of the internet and its technologies.
You call all of these destructions the Chronos effect?
Yeah, the second god in Greek history, god of the universe, it was foretold that his children would replace him in some ways or unseat him, and so he took every child and ate it. And it seems a little grotesque, but it's a little bit.
Eventually, Zeus survived.
Yeah, well, they snuck in a stone instead of Zeus, so Zeus survived and overthrew him. But there's a real tendency of powerful incumbent tech companies to either co-opt or eat alive technologies that challenge their rule.
In some cases, their own invention. You point out that Bell invented the answering machine in the 1930s.
Yeah, they invented the tape recorder in the late 1920s, early 1930s. They invented mobile telephony even earlier, 1910s. But with the tape recorder, I had a Bell memo, a fascinating memo, that suggested that if the tape recorder became widespread, people would stop using the telephone, that the telephone would become extinct because of the tape recorder. So they suppressed it for 40 years. They were worried that so many people use a telephone to talk about obscene matters or indecency that they would be terrified that they'd be talking about something and then it would be recorded. So everyone would abandon the telephone. So they suppress the technology.
And, of course, the answering machine and taping and all of that has only helped the telephone.
Eventually.
And I mean, of course, we call it voicemail now.
Yeah, we call it voicemail. And even more important, the magnetic recording technology underlying it is what led to the hard drive, which is essential to the computer revolution.
But we've also seen resistance from the TV industry to the DVR machines. The record industry sure fought the ability to record CDs.
Yeah, and of course they've fought online downloads for a very long time until eventually iTunes. Yeah, so there's a real natural tendency for existing powers to try to destroy things that might unseat their model.
Well, in Google, what you're, I'm assuming, Google is what you're referring to in your title as the master switch.
Not necessarily. The title comes from a quote from Fred Friendly, who's a famous president of CBS News and later a public television advocate. And he said in his famous quote, he said, the issue here is not First Amendment, not censorship, but exclusive custody of the master switch, suggesting there's a level of control over what Americans see or hear that operates at a completely deeper level than this superficial discussion about the First Amendment, that it has to do with who has control over the channels of information. He worked at CBS News, so he was very aware of how his decisions had an influence on things like the Vietnam War and other questions. So there's always a struggle to control the master switch in American society, and Google is obviously one of the contenders right now to be the master switch.
And when other people come along with competition, Microsoft has just come up with another thing. I tried it. It's not as good as Google, so
right.
I didn't stick with it.
Yeah, it's extremely hard. Interesting to me is that even though we thought that the internet was supposed to create a sort of a paradise of competition where every company would be displaced in 1 or 2 years, we've had a growth over the last 5 years of internet monopolies. Mostly extremely good companies, Google and Facebook and Apple and Amazon. But it is nonetheless true that we are living, again, in an age of monopolies.
Why do you argue that the move towards smartphones and away from computers threatens openness?
Well, the smartphone, I love smartphones. I have one myself, obviously. Smartphones are telephones. They're not computers, and so they're underlying DNA is more oriented towards a controlled, closed experience, and it's difficult to make it more like a computer. Now, actually, Google is trying to do that because Google depends on an open market. That's the idea of the Android phone, but it is by its nature historically still a telephone.
What about computers that we took for granted haven't transferred over to the smartphone?
Well, what's interesting about computers is they empower everyone to become a creator. They're fundamentally much easier. You know, you open up a program, you can paint something, you can write essays, blogs. A phone is much harder to do that with, and it makes the internet much more of a consumption product, like television. Mm-hmm. The iPad is like that too. The iPad is for consumption. It's not for creation. I think there's something important.
Even though you have a keyboard and you can type. You could write a novel on an iPod.
Have you ever tried? Have you ever tried to write something longer than an email on an iPad? It's not. It's doable in the sense that you could also, you know, draw. You could write essays with crayons, but it's not something. It doesn't enable creation. It's a functionally and there's a deep question about American society as to whether we're a society of creators or a society of consumers. Obviously, we're both, but I think at our best, we're a creative people.
I was thinking about Skype. You can't access it on a smartphone because then you'd be making phone calls for free.
Yeah, it's an ongoing battle that Skype has to try and you know, get on the smartphone platform. The truth is that if Skype, if Spectrum were more open, it's a different issue, and if Skype were more freely available, we could pay a lot less for phone bills just to make a straightforward consumer point.
What other ways is competition being pushed out on in the internet now?
Well, I just think that, like I said, I think increasingly, and it's not always by pernicious action, some of it's quite natural, we just are living in an age where many of the markets are a single company. eBay, Amazon, Google, all of these, Facebook, you know, all of these have no real effective competitors.
But to some degree, it's because they did their jobs well,
yeah, that's right,
and people gravitated toward them. There were other Facebook came along after others were already there. It just did a job that people preferred.
Right, and that's why I'm not launching a massive attack on these companies. I think they have done a good job. I'm just saying that now that they are monopolies, we have to be aware that there are long-term dangers. A lot of short-term benefit in monopoly. The great companies, like I use them all myself. But there are long-term dangers if a monopolist stays in power for a long time. Like an incumbent congressman or a dictator, they become interested much less in trying to improve the product and much more in trying to stay in power. And so, yes, we're in sort of a golden age even, but we need to keep a careful watch from these monopolies that we're controlling, that we're creating.
My guest is Tim Wu. W.U. His book, The Master Switch, The Rise and Fall of Information Empires, is published by Knopf. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. What does net neutrality, a term that you coined?
Yeah.
What do you mean by it?
Net neutrality is a principle of openness for the internet. It says that even though there's a lot of companies that are carrying information over the internet, they should deliver what you want on a non-discriminatory basis. So when you, the user or the customer, you want to go to this blog or that website, you should be able to get what you want, not what the carrier makes available to you. It's a principle of non-discrimination.
But then people complain that their kids can get pornography, that
it's fine.
Amazon is carrying books that have, that many people consider disgusting.
Right. It's fine for people, I suggest, to block the internet themselves. You know, if I want to limit my children from going to porn sites, that's fine. The problem, in my mind, comes when you have carriers at the center who block sites because they don't like them, which is censorship, or because they're a competitive threat. So if Verizon, for example, were to block Bing or to block Facebook because it has a deal with MySpace or something, that's when you have a real limit in American choices.
We see that in cable television.
Yeah, cable television is not a model for the internet. It's an example of what goes wrong. And partially, you're right. There are limits on what they can block, but right now we're having this big battle between Fox and Cablevision.
Yeah, but if you go to Verizon, you don't get all of the channels that Time Warner controls because then Cablevision has its own things that it owns that you can't get on some of the other systems.
Yeah, that's true. There are some rules in the FCC blocking the most egregious examples of that, which are a form of net neutrality rule, in fact. But the basic idea is consumer sovereignty, or users. We, the people, make the choices of what information we want to consume. That's the essence of net neutrality. It sounds like an abstract principle, but it's all about being able to get stuff without being blocked by an intermediary.
Are there monopolies that benefit from net neutrality?
That's an interesting question. That monopolies or companies that offer more choice, Google is the greatest example of it, I suppose, do benefit from that. But in my mind, if you're offering consumers more choice, you deserve to benefit.
When you were working in Silicon Valley, were these things being discussed?
You know, I was working there in the early 2000s, and that's why I feel like I saw a lot of this coming. One of my jobs was to try to sell the Chinese government on censorship technology, essentially. Technology they could use to block Taiwanese dissidents or Tibetan or religious movements. And I looked at this and I thought, you know, this is not... And it was the same technology that they were also trying to sell to American companies to try and favor one product over another. And it made me realize that this sort of centralized control could be used for political censorship or for commercial censorship.
What's your solution to ending the cycle that you've identified in information industries?
It's a really great question. I'm not sure it can be completely ended because I do believe monopolies rise and fall, and it's difficult to absolutely end that. I think we need to have a greater appreciation of the dangers and to try to, most importantly, what I say in the book is something called the separation principle, which is we should try to make sure that there's not too much overlap between content creation and content carriage, that these two functions need to be somewhat separate. So the people who own the wires don't decide what content Americans see.
So a content owner, let's say somebody who develops games, would be different from somebody like a cable company that is involved with the network infrastructure.
Right.
Then there's somebody else who makes a mobile handset.
Right, that's right. You divide the industry, some level of division.
Isn't that what we did in the past? We did that when we broke up the studios and the movie theaters.
Exactly. So this has been done before, and I thought that was right. This in the 1950s, the federal government broke the movie studios' control over all the theaters because they said, you know what, theaters should be able to choose what movies they want to carry. The result was a rebirth of American cinema, the 1970s, what people call New Hollywood. There are very important creative effects from deintegration of American media, and it sounds wonky and hard to understand, but it's essential to real freedom, of speech.
But it would involve some kind of government regulation, and right now the mood is against government regulation.
I don't think it requires government regulation to have a policy.
To keep these things separate?
What it requires, first of all, is a norm that Americans are very suspect, that we become aware and suspect of crossing lines, of knowing of your information carrier controlling what you're seeing. More powerful than any law is the reaction of the American people to censorship, even private censorship.
Well, a lot of the censorship we've experienced has been self-censorship, people co-opting the censorship role. We saw that with the production code in Hollywood.
That's right.
Where governments were banning different cities,
right.
Were banning movies, states. So Hollywood took over the role, and that led to some pretty banal movies.
Yeah, that's right. This is a big point of my book is that we are insufficiently sensitive to the dangers of private censorship. Whether you're left or right wing, you should care about censorship. And the most egregious example in the 20th century of censorship was when the film industry had to clear every script through the Catholic Church before it made a film. We had for almost 30 years one man deciding what film could be made in America. That doesn't sound like free speech at all. You had one man deciding, based on a production code, whether this script could become a movie or not. And that's just crazy, and we can't let that happen again.
Well, what can we do as private individuals to stem the tide?
I think private individuals need to take a sense of ownership of the information they choose to consume. That is, they have to feel that I have the right to reach the information I want to reach, as long as it's legal. But in general, I have the right to – and if someone is deciding for me or blocking me from what I want to reach – I need to react. That's much more powerful than any law, a sense that the internet is something I own in a way that is my – and I get to go where I want to go.
Tim Wu's book, The Master Switch, The Rise and Fall of Information Empires, is published by Knopf. Thank you so much for being with us today.
It's been a great pleasure. Thanks so much for the questions.